my advice to the CEO would be raise enough to hit the next milestone. And therefore, what is the next business milestone you're trying to hit? Is it, you know, launching a new product? Is it, you know, you're trying to show better unit economics? Is it that you're trying to show repeatability of sales? And so first and foremost, how much you raise has to be driven by the progress you're trying to show to your next investor. And every investor in every stage has a mental model of what they want to see. If you are, Series A investor, you're taking a lot of execution risk, you're taking a lot of team risk, and you're looking for, you have a product market fit risk you're taking as well. When you are a Series B investor, you want that product market risk to start getting de-risked, and so the company should have a couple million in ARR. And once you start to get to Series C, Series D, and particularly the crossover investors, they want to see a really good machine humming in terms of the magic number, the sales efficiency ratios, the gross margins, the margin mix, the revenue mix, how many of your reps are hitting quota. Like all of those things start to come into play. And frankly, a lot of the work I did in private equity, it's the very, very, very disciplined, methodical, surgical approach to analyzing businesses that private equity brings to the bear. So with that, with all that being said, the business milestone is really important, and therefore, you know, at least 18 months, if not more. So
hello and welcome to Fireside with a VC. My name is Andrew Romans, and today we're with Vipor Rastogi, who is the head of City Ventures Group, responsible for all AI, ML, and data investments. Very hot topic, so there's probably a lot of VCs chasing this, but few of the global resources of City Ventures. I want to focus today on understanding a deep dive on valuations and where the market is and where that's changing. Vipor has a bird's eye seat at that, seeing just a tremendous amount of deal flow and what gets done. Well, I'd then like to take a deep dive in understanding the City Ventures strategy, talk a little bit about corporate venture capital in general, and if there's time, maybe wrap up on exits and where the market is. Vipor, I want to leave time to get into the good stuff, so I'll give a quick background on Vipor. He beat out, 50,000 people per seat to get into the IIT before they kind of franchised that model out, so it's a bit like if you're on the American Olympic team for basketball, it's how many people got to that. So I always think that's amazing. IIT also completed MBA at Chicago Booth. I believe Vipor, you began your career at Deloitte, then got into product management at Intel, and then crossed the path into Intel Capital. So bringing, that classic CVC experience, the longest lasting continuous CVC probably in the world, Intel Capital. And then I guess you were with AI Symphony. Was that a buyout firm, acquiring and rolling up AI? So deep expertise in the area that you've been mandated with, at Citi. But Vipor, great to see you. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, it's good to see you, Andrew. Thank you.
I think the last time we saw each other was on the VC panel in San Francisco at the 7BC event, November 14th.
Yeah, so that was great. I made a lot of good friends there. And in fact, I caught up with Ben after the event as well. So it was... it was a great event.
Yeah, Ben Black's always good. If you have him on a panel, it's probably going to be a lot of smiles and a few laughs, but getting into the real stuff. But the great thing for having you on those and on this podcast is that you are indeed so active. And does City Ventures have an annual budget, or you don't even really pay attention? I mean, I know you talk about something like 5 billion or 4 billion of exits, which is something you don't hear a lot of VCs bragging about, as the DPI is so weak, compared to where it should be. But what is generally the annual investment AUM being deployed?
Yeah. So at Citi, we have three different investment teams. And across the three investment teams, an annual budget is in the $400 million to $500 million range. So we are a balance sheet investor. We don't take outside capital, but that's our pace of activity. We have the team that I'm part of, Citi Ventures, and we invest on behalf of our personal banking and wealth business, as well as our operations and technology business. We have another group that invests on behalf of our various institutional businesses. So that's our capital markets group, our security services group, our treasury and trade group. And then we have another impact fund that invests in ESG, DEI, climate change transition in areas like those. So those are the three separate investment teams at Citi.
Okay, I think the impact one that started in 2020, right? So just sort of like...
That's
okay. Okay. That's interesting. If there's time, I'd like to talk about that. Well, one topic that I think is just very important for everybody to understand, whether you're the incumbent VC who funded the last round and you're trying to advise the company on what do we do to not run out of money, and it's obvious we're going to raise another round, is how do you calculate, and feel free to talk about this from seed to pre-IPO late stage, how much money should a startup be raising? And of course, the answer is it depends, but maybe give us some context of how to think about that. And what is the sensible thing to, you want to make your fundraising attractive to end up with the best investors that can add the most value and getting your choice of investors rather than alienate, you know, people from silly valuations. How do you think about valuations these days? And it's an ever-changing market, you know, marketplace.
Yeah. Yeah. So Andrew, I mean, you and I have been in venture capital for a long time, and you know, the calculus of how much capital you should raise and how long should that capital raise last and how much of the company you're giving away for that round, you know, it has really changed from when I started out in venture capital in 2010. And clearly in 2021, you know, all those playbooks, all those rules were out the window in how people thought about those that equation. But you know, in general, when if a portfolio company CEO came to me with that question and asked, hey, how should I think about quantum of capital raise? My advice to the CEO would be raise enough to hit the next milestone. And therefore, what is the next business milestone you're trying to hit? Is it, you know, launching a new product? Is it, you know, you're trying to show better unit economics? Is it that you're trying to show repeatability of sales? And so first and foremost, how much you raise has to be driven by the progress you're trying to show to your next investor. And every investor in every stage has a mental model of what they want to see. If you're a Series A investor, you're taking a lot of execution risk, you're taking a lot of team risk, and you're looking for, you have a product market fit risk you're taking as well. When you are a Series B investor, you want that product market risk to start getting de-risked. And so the company should have a couple million in ARR. And once you start to get to Series C, Series D, and particularly the crossover investors, they want to see a really good machine humming in terms of the magic number, the sales efficiency ratios, the gross margins, the margin mix, the revenue mix, how many of your reps are hitting quota. Like all of those things start to come into play. And frankly, a lot of the work I did in private equity, it's the very, very, very disciplined, methodical, surgical approach to analyzing businesses that private equity brings to the bear. So with that, with all that being said, you know, the business milestone is really important, and therefore, you know, at least 18 months, if not more. So right. Raise enough. Look at your operating
runway. Cash runway. And when you calculate, I mean, we look at cash runway and say, how much money is in the bank? How much money will be in the bank after we complete this financing? And we may be increasing monthly spend as our operating plan. And we kind of say, if sales are flat, maybe make a little exception for we know it's coming. But in general, if sales are flat at that monthly spend, how many months cash runway before we hit a zero bank balance? How do you, do you take into a lot of consideration some hopeful hockey stick that's coming, or how do you calculate runway?
Yeah, no. So we some of our CEOs do exactly that as well, Andrew, and you know, and they you know take a very, very conservative approach. I'm somewhere in the middle because obviously we invest in these businesses because we do want new ARR and expansion ARR to happen. So obviously, if the CEO came back and said, you know, historical growth was 100%, but next year growth will be 200 or 300%. You know, we will have a, you know, long conversation about, you know, being realistic, or maybe there is a change in the market that's driving that. But you know, but by and large, there is a, you know, I only invest in enterprise, so there is a sales cycle to these businesses. There is, you know, I mean, there are budgets and there are long contract negotiation cycles, and therefore there is, you know, not an, the growth is not given, unlike consumer businesses where you can go viral and you know, growth can be stratospheric for the right business. And therefore, you know, we do want to see new ARR and expansion ARR being part of the calculus, but, you know, realistic
right.
new ARR and expansion ARR to calculate the runway. But I tell our CEOs, raise enough so that you can have 18 to 24 months of cash runway. And usually that's enough to show the next milestone. But in some companies, you know, particularly some of the AI companies, they may need longer. I mean, just yesterday, you know, I talked to a company that's working on autonomous agents. And they will be in research for a long time. So clearly this 18 month is wouldn't be a good advice for them because there is some R&D that, you know, fundamental R&D they had to do, same as OpenAI. You know, Vinod didn't fund the company and said 18 months later, you need to have, you know, ChatGPT out in the market. It took them a good 4 or 5 years before they had the basic, you know, the research done on transformers, and then putting that consumer app together to ultimately take it to market, right? So fundamental innovation doesn't go very predictably, and so you need to give the company enough time to hit the milestone they want to hit.
Yeah, I think that when you say 18-month runway, that means theoretically zero cash in the bank from a conservative forecast in 18 months. And you don't want to reach out to target.
I want to give enough time for fundraising as well, right? So,
right.
So the 18-month runway, you need to have, the point is that you need to have at least, you need to give at least, you know, 1 to 2 quarters of capital raise. And then I'm sure we'll discuss the current capital raise environment as well. You know, so people are not flinging term sheets at you and rounds are not getting done in 30 days. Other than a few spaces like clearly generative AI. And therefore, we do want the CEOs to have at least 2 quarters you know, to give themselves enough time for 2 quarters of fundraising. So raise enough capital such that and have a 2-quarter of buffer to give yourself time to capital raise. So do not run out of cash basically until you can hit the milestones and get enough capital for the next round and the next investor.
So this may sound extremely obvious, but I just think it's some of the most valuable advice you can ever hear is to say, look, you know, we got to make enough progress from where we are now with this funding, so that maybe even a year from now, 12 months from now, I've got 6 months cash in the bank to run a fundraising process. And the speed at which deals are getting done, thankfully, has slowed down from their momentary lapse of reason in 2021, right? Now, what are some, there's a lot of art and there's a little bit of science. There's probably more science when you're at Symphony AI. But for venture financings ranging from, let's say a company's got $1 million in revenue or $5 million in revenue. How are you? I mean, public markets look at discounted cash flows and comps, you know, as sort of, you know, I'm going to grip to something there on determining share price or market capitalization. What are some basic ideas that you think of when saying what percentage of the share capital should be sold to the new investors in this financing round? And what are some building blocks that drive that valuation for you?
Yeah, so on dilution, just as the first order of business, I mean, I advise our CEOs that, you know, obviously they will end up giving, you know, maybe 20% of the company in Series A, and therefore if the you know round came together at 50 million, you know, post, then typically you're raising 10 million in a Series A at a 50 post, right? But then every subsequent round of financing, hopefully you're giving 10% or thereabouts in every subsequent financing. So if every round hopefully is a 2x from the last round, if the company is showing good ARR growth, good sales efficiency and so forth. So, you know, in the next round, maybe you can raise, you know, 20 million at a high valuation or 10 million at 100 million valuation and so forth. But you're, you know, trying to give up only 10% of the company in subsequent rounds. And hopefully management team at exit owns at least 30% of the company. So if they've raised 4 or 5 rounds of financing before an exit event happens, M&A or IPO, you know, hopefully the CEO, the founders and the management team has at least 30, if not more, of the company to keep them incentivized. Now, coming to valuations themselves and you know, the art and science of the valuation. So we think about exit valuations. So and that is where it takes a lot of imagination to think about what can a company in any particular market be worth. And in some new markets, it's impossible to know how big some of these things can be. You know, like, for example, you know, we're investing in enterprise generative AI, and it's so new and so nascent. But then, you know, you have to at least put some level of assumptions on the table and think about, you know, what can a good realistic exit be in a base case scenario, in an upside case scenario, and a downside scenario. And with all of those valuation, with all of those different exit scenarios, then we think about what is how much risk we are taking in the series we are coming in, and what kind of multiple we should have for the risk we are taking. So, you know, we for Series A financings, we are looking to get 10 times our capital. For Series B financings, we're looking to get 7 times our capital. Series C financing, we're looking to get 5 times our capital. For Series D, E, typically we're looking to get 3 times our capital, and 3x is our floor. We won't do an investment if we don't think that we can at least get a 3x return, MOIC return. And so based on all that, you basically say, okay, what is the company likely to be worth at exit? What is the valuation, and discounting it back to the present? You know, what is it that we are worth? So we are not doing year by year DCF like I used to do in my private equity world, but more, you know, from here to exit, you know, what valuation gain should happen, and discount it back to the present. You know, we think of the value of the business.
And this would change across stage, but if you're investing as a Series A investment, what percentage dilution do you expect to get? So if you invest at a simple math, $100 million valuation, which would be very spicy for a Series A, but just for simple math, it's 100. If it sells at 10x, that means it's exiting, getting liquid at $1 billion, but there's going to be more funding rounds, right? So you're not going, you're going to take a haircut on that. So how do you think of dilution impacting the exit, to take away from this fantasy math of I invested at 100, it'll exit at a billion without dilution?
Yeah, so the dilution would be, you know, that what I discussed, which is, you know, we expect that there'll be at least 4 or 5 more rounds of financing, and in each one there is 10% dilution. So the ownership, the 20% ownership, should get diluted by about 50% by the time it exits. So if I didn't do my pro rata, then my, you know, my Series A 20% should be, you know, 10 would be 10%, you know, by the time the company exits. So,
okay.
And then the, you know, and then, you know, 40% dilution if you came in the B, and, you know, and so on.
And as a multi-stage investor, you probably are investing your pro rata or super pro rata, but we'll come to specifically what the city strategy is. And do you ever think of multiple on ARR as you know, a guidepost of that's very expensive and spicy given the ARR, or that's quite fair given the ARR? So if a company's got its proprietary AI tech, you know, you could start building yourself up and saying, hey, these guys have their own proprietary AI tech, this is serious stuff. You know, when you look at the multiple of that, it's not so spicy, whereas somebody with just a layer on top of OpenAI might not be so interesting.
We do. And you know, clearly that's an important metric because you want to understand how the market is looking at deals at this stage for this type of company. You know, the benefit of doing that exit analysis and discounting back to the present is it tries to get away from the current hype.
Yes.
And so, you know, and therefore, and again, this is the private equity discipline, which is you never want to assume that just because there is zero interest rate period, you know, 5 years from now when I'm exiting, you know, we'll have the same, you know, interest rate benefit that current companies are getting. And therefore, in a more normalized environment, what would an exit look like? And therefore, what should I be paying for this business? I mean, you may recall at one point, Snowflake was trading at 100 times ARR, and it's now trading at 15 times ARR. You know, when I started in venture, SaaS deals in public markets would trade at 5 times ARR. And then, and more recently, a normal SaaS company now in public markets also trades at 6-7 times ARR, right? So there's always reversion to the mean in public markets. And a lot of late stage valuations, whether it's M&A or IPO, are driven by, you know, ultimately where the public markets are. So that's why, while we will look at, you know, how investors are valuing these companies, and particularly in AI, I mean, deals are getting done at, you know, 40, 50, 60 times ARR. But, you know, again, looking at this exit analysis allows us to think about when the hype cycle may cool down and somebody may only be willing to pay 10 times forward ARR for this business, then what should the exit would need to be? What would the ARR need to be? Is the ARR realistic? Will it help us hit our MOIC hurdle? So we tried to incorporate all that in our analysis.
Yeah, I think looking at the exit and backing your way into today's round is a very sensible way to not get caught up in all this excitement of, oh, Eric Schmidt and Mark Andreessen love it. Maybe they can afford to just throw money away that I can't. So kind of bring some sanity checking on that. So maybe switch gears to City Ventures. So not including the Impact 2020 vintage, what is the core strategy of City? When should entrepreneurs listening to this, or even VCs making a target list for the next funding round, when should they reach out to you? What stage are you looking for? Obviously, your job title, you know, talks about AI, data, ML, but what are you guys hunting for?
Yeah, so City Ventures, our group got started in 2010. We were co-founded by two GPs who joined City from Battery and Menlo. So Arvind Purushottam, who currently runs a group, he was a GP at Menlo Ventures, and one of our other GPs who's no longer with City Ventures, you know, came from Battery. And so they wanted, they started a firm that would have all the practices of, you know, traditional venture firms, but with the added benefit of having Citi as our institutional limited partner, or, you know, and our balance sheet investor. And so getting all the benefits of scaling these companies within Citi. So since our founding, Citi Ventures has done about 150 investments. We have 100 active portfolio companies. And 50% of our companies have a commercial relationship with Citi. So in many cases, we are their largest customer. So names that you'd be familiar with: Harness, Sneak, Cribble, Docker, Matillion, Netscope. These are all current investments of our security.ai. And you know, in many cases, we are the largest customer. So really, our value add to companies is when they are, you know, transitioning from the Series A stage to really going into the large enterprise. And, you know, Citi is a global, almost $80 billion business, presence in 100 countries. It's a 200-year-old bank, 220,000 employees, 100 million retail customers, 14,000 institutional customers. So, you know, our needs are and scale make it very unique. You know, we have 80 petabytes of data. We have 70 million documents. So if you're an enterprise AI company, you know, we have a massive data set that we want to partner with enterprise AI companies to help unlock the value in. So, you know, so when companies are trying to scale to large enterprises, that's where we can be the most value added. We can help them with, you know, thinking about what product they should be building, how they should approach go to market. What does security infosec look like? What does the procurement process look like? How do you land and expand? You know, what does the if you have to deploy in a VPC, you know, how does that provisioning and manageability look like? Because as Citi, it's, you know, very security sensitive. And in financial services, there's a lot of reference selling. So you know, our needs are the same as, say, Bank of America or JP Morgan or Wells Fargo, and vice versa. So, you know, Wall Street collectively spends about $300 billion on tech every year. We spend $12 billion on tech every year. So it's a massive vertical to unlock by working with us. And a lot of our portfolio companies have done that very successfully.
How many employees are employed across all of Citi?
240,000.
That's amazing. Yeah, so I mean, you could probably go well beyond financial services. I mean, there's in the IT budget alone, like I heard, like B of A Merrill Lynch, you know, is like the biggest IT company in the world or something, just based on headcount or something like that. So
JP Morgan, probably. My guess is it will be JP Morgan. JP Morgan spends about $14 billion on technology per year. So yeah, they would be probably one of the largest out there in terms of tech spend and headcount. But yeah, no, you're right. Like, you know, our needs are not that different from, say, a Walmart or Walmart in retail, or, you know, a General Motors in manufacturing. So, you know, the same security, infosec, contracting, legal, procurement processes we put our companies through, most large enterprises will do the same. And so there's and we handhold our companies through all of these various processes. You know, we help them think, you know, in terms of what kind of security certifications they need to have. Like one of our portfolio companies, we help them get SOC 2 Type 2 certification, because that was a requirement for them to work with us and host confidential data that we have and so forth. So there's a lot of these enterprise learnings that we can help our founders with.
I used to joke that if all you did was sit outside of the IT purchasing department at Citibank, you could probably have a top performing venture capital fund, because Citi becomes a customer and it's a domino effect for JPM Chase and everybody else. But that's good. And I think you'd mentioned once, maybe this was when you were at Intel Capital, that you invested in the company as a venture investor and then acquired the company, making a strong banner IRR. So it sounded like it might have been investment and the acquisition happened shortly after. And we've seen this when we've introduced portfolio companies to a CVC, corporate venture investor, that then buys the company. And I'm kind of curious to hear, and maybe there's no good answer to it, but on the one hand, you invest in the company, you want to have a personal track record, you want the CFO to be happy about this. I mean, you know, $102 billion every 10 years you guys are deploying, that you're returning at least that. On the other hand, the CEO might not be pleased with you if he overpaid for the acquisition. So there's a little of a balancing act of, you invest in the company, Citi's going to buy it, or Intel's going to buy it, and maybe remove yourself from Citi Ventures and speak in general as someone who knows a lot about corporate venturing. How do you balance certain kind of conflicts like that? Do I want to sell the company for a high amount, or do I want to buy it for a low amount?
Yeah. No, so look, you want to do all transactions, first of all, at arm's length at market prices, right? Like, so, you know, whether, you know, so when you are both the quote unquote a seller as a minority investor, and then you're a buyer as a full owner, both those transactions have to happen at arm's length and at market prices. So I think that is the fundamental operating principle. And typically, so I can speak to maybe Intel, but broadly CVCs. You know, you do try to make sure that there is a Chinese wall between those two constituents, right? So that you first of all, you know, reputation matters. Reputation is everything. So you do not want to give anyone any specific advantage in that buy process, just because they have some special access to some information that others don't, et cetera. So the legal teams within CVCs, they typically, you know, are very, very, you know, very, very protective and, you know, sensitive to what is being shared. The operating principle is you should go back to the company. If you're a buyer, if you're the corp dev group that's on the M&A side and wants to buy the company, all the information has to be disclosed by the company and on an equal access with equal giving everybody equal time to process the information. So you have to basically work with the M&A process. Now, you know, in that very particular situation, this was a variable company. You know, I'd invested in a company, Basis Sciences, was a co-investor in with Norvest and Mayfield and DCM. And it was just when the first generation of wearables were taking off. This particular company, they had really innovated around heart rate sensors, a number of those that subsequently Apple Watch and others introduced as well. So they had some of the best sensor fusion technology, both the sensors as well as the sensor fusion technology in the market. Pretty soon after we made the investment, Intel decided to actually get in the wearables market because the idea was that a lot of these will use small microprocessor, but more importantly, there'll be a lot of health data coming from these devices. And Intel, you know, sells a lot of data center hardware, so can really benefit from all the compute and processing that would happen. So a company got a LOI from a buyer, a large tech company, and I approached the CEO and I said, you know, I understand we have this LOI. I think Intel may be interested in potentially being part of the process, and I can put you in touch with the head of M&A who would be quite interested in meeting you. And so so you have to socialize the idea with the CEO. The CEO took it to the board. The board, board gave the CEO the go ahead to engage. And at that point, I had to recuse myself.
Right.
From both the board deliberations as well as the internal deliberations. So in some sense, after the initial matchmaking, right, you cannot be advising the CEO or advising the internal party. So that is the one downside is, you know, unlike a regular M&A where, you know, I am a business partner to the CEO, and I'm, you know, if there was any other M&A transaction with an unrelated third party, you know, I'll be working with the CEO on a very hands-on basis in helping him think through deal structuring, process, you know, the value, earn out, and all those matters. But in this case, you basically, you know, completely cut out of all information flow. And at some point, you know, if a transaction is going through or not going through. And when you go through, you find out like everyone else. But I think that's the right way to run these transactions.
I really agree. And I'll tell you, having really spent a lot of time in this and written books about corporate venture capital, not everybody does it this way. And you know, you say it's a downside. Yeah, they're going to miss the VPOR handholding advice on going through the transaction. But then again, you made a pretty big introduction of what's probably going to be the definitive exit for the company. And so you did that one job very well. You step out and hopefully they've got other people, you know, on the board that are purely financial, that can, you know, replace you for giving that advice. So I think it's pretty valuable if you can bring a buyer to the table and not get in the middle and make it messy. I won't say names, but there's some big Fortune 500 companies where the person's business card says head of M&A, head of corporate development and investments. And so it's a fiber optic link, not a Chinese firewall, you know, or Chinese wall, you know, separating the information. I think you said it well. Reputation's everything. And you know, if you think you want to sell your company to this business, letting them on the cap table may not make sense if you know it's the same person that does the investing and the buying, on that topic. What about, so maybe technology. You've been an AI investor since before a lot of the, or from the first hype cycles, maybe, right? Mm-hmm. And seen it kind of come and go. What are some specific technologies? I mean, I like the way you mentioned that Citi has just so many contracts and PDF data to not be letting computers essentially get in there with NLP and make some sense of it. It is just an enormous missed opportunity. What are some technologies that are exciting you right now, either you're investing in or just looking at that you think are essential to the evolution of humankind here?
Yeah. So I think the full generative AI stack, right? We are very, very excited about it. So last year, it's a board and CEO level initiative. Last year, you know, we went around the company and there was a, you know, very senior level task force that was created around generative AI. You know, the entire company was solicited for use cases based on the potential of their technology. And about 200 use cases were submitted by various, you know, various teams in, you know, finance, risk, legal, HR, sales and marketing, different product teams. And of those 200, about 12 were prioritized, where the idea was that if we can start to prototype these 12 use cases and really go and investigate what's the state of the art that can solve these 12 use cases, take them to production, start to scale these use cases, and then we can go back and look at the fuller list that was submitted. So along that dimension, you know, we're working with Microsoft with, you know, for OpenAI. You know, we are working with Llama 2, more on the open source front. You know, we are also working with some of the other cloud providers like Google and Amazon as well, and some of their model offerings. We are looking at the entire value chain from how do you bring data to these LLMs. So, you know, companies like unstructured.io that help you take data from documents and feed LLMs, vector databases like Pinecone that can help you do embeddings and store embeddings, all the way to application companies that, you know, like LangChain, you know, which are, you know, generative AI frameworks, as well as, you know, companies that do security for large language models and make sure there is no data breach risk, as well as companies that are helping with governance for these generative AI models. So to make sure that whether it's the EU AI Act or the White House executive order, that all of these models are, you know, compliant. And then obviously bias and hallucination, making sure that you don't have issues with the output from these models. And then ultimately, we need to be running these in production, so monitoring these large language models. So when a certain prompt is given into these models with context, with RAG, you know, what is the output and how does the output relate to the input? And if there was issues with the prompt, and how can we further give it more training examples for the output to be more relevant and contextual. So yeah, so it's a super exciting area. We are investing in several companies. We'll be announcing an investment in an enterprise search company that is using generative AI to find information in corporate documents and surface that and summarize them to employees. So it's a ex-Google team that has founded this company. This is a really, really exciting area for us.
And I have a sense of this because we exchanged deal flow, but what stage is it suitable for you to make an entry point investment? You'd mentioned seeking to make a 10x return on a Series A investment. What would you define as the stage characteristics? How far along is a company? It might be different if you're making a Vinod investment of 5 years of R&D, but how should we think about when to bother you with a deal?
Yeah, so Andrew, we are truly stage agnostic. You know, last year we did several seed stage companies as well, where, you know, they wanted to do a design partnership with us and really wanted to, you know, learn some aspect of their product market fit and go to market, all the way to investing in some very late stage companies that are maybe 2 years away from IPO. So we do run the full gamut. But I would say most of our investments tend to be Series B and C. So while we'll do seeds and Series A's, we have done a lot of D's and E's. A majority of our investments, I think almost 70% of investments, are in the B and C range. So this is where, you know, you have, you know, a couple million dollars in ARR, you have some enterprise customers, and you're really trying to get the next level of evolution in your company and basically go after large enterprises. So you have a team that can handle RFPs and RFIs, and you have a, you know, team that can handle InfoSec, and you have a team that can handle production support and SLAs, and you have a good customer success and support team that can handle, you know, how to work with a business like ours is, you know, 24/7 and global. So you have some of that infrastructure in place, and then we can partner with them. But, you know, but having said that, we've done like the seeds and Series A's, and there, you know, we just set some expectations that for the seed stage companies in particular, that, you know, with, you know, landing Citi as a customer or a partner, maybe later in their journey, then it won't be, you know, 12 months after we make an investment, because they have to mature as a company before Citi would be willing, ready to and able to engage with them.
I was impressed when you said you have about a 50% hit rate of some kind of commercial agreement between Citi and the portfolio company. And if you required that only, which some early CVCs did in like the 90s, like you have to get the signature of the head of a BU at Motorola saying you're gonna not invent it at home and invent it here and do business with them, you kind of had to make the enterprise sale before you could get the check out of Moto Ventures, you know, and that was like demanding signature evidence of strategic fit and not just making financial investments without minding the strategic side of the mandate. But I think that if you're bringing a very early stage company to a business unit within the corporation in the context of CBC, there's going to be resistance of the BU saying, I don't want to be the guinea pig for this thing. Whereas if they've got a couple ARR of revenue, they're big enough to handle the SLAs and all this kind of compliance stuff, dealing with a 24/7 global player, your hit rate goes up and the value is there. But even if it's, I mean, that's pretty cool that you managed to get like pulling from the entire company to say, what are the distilling it down to 12 topics for the AI task force that can guide investment themes and to be able to maybe guide some strategic decisions. Like kind of like the most important 100 decisions are probably made by the time you get into a Series B. So if, right. if they can understand what a serious technology company like Citi is talking about as a top 12 topic to focus on, that could be, you know, pretty interesting for the startup. I often say, talk to these guys, and if you don't want their funding, don't take their funding. Maybe they'll wow and woo you to get you to do it, but find out what they're doing and they might fast track you to a potential customer, even if it's a year away. That's pretty good. Well, why don't we wrap up on exits and even the health of the industry. Not every venture firm is able to just snap their fingers and continue to get the latest, you know, 100 million of cash to be deployed. Distributions in the industry have been a bit drier than we'd like. I think when we should have been all selling in 2021 at those insane multiples, we were all raising at even dumber multiples. And now we're kind of dealing with a hangover of still not exiting those every one of those companies. Where do you see the M&A market? Do we have a solid window opening? Have multiples recovered enough that people are willing to go ahead and take their 4x return or whatever they're getting? And maybe what's your perspective on the IPO market? And we're having this conversation early February 2024.
Yeah. So I think on the maybe the IPO market's a bit easier in the sense that I think this year will continue to be somewhat challenging for the IPO markets. You know, we had, you know, Klaviyo and Instacart last year. And obviously, there's some great names like Databricks that are, you know, primed to go public whenever the public markets are receptive. But, you know, I think given the interest rates, you know, Fed decided to leave the interest rate unchanged, and, you know, interest rates may come down by, who knows, 100 basis points by the end of the year, but it'll still be fairly high. And everybody looks at you know, tech companies multiple as a spread to the Fed funds rate. And so as long as that keep, you know, that is high, your discount rate on the return you're looking at tech companies will be high, and then therefore valuations will not be as robust as people would like. So I think IPO markets, you know, maybe it's a next year story versus a 2024 story. As far as M&A also is challenged primarily given the fact that a lot of companies have really not adjusted to the new reality, that whatever valuation mark they had, you know, was a fictitious number, and the intrinsic value to a buyer is much, much lower, right? We're starting to see a few, you know, down acquisitions happening where companies are, you know, running out of runway, or sellers are deciding that, this is the best price we can get in the market, but not enough. So I think the corp dev groups for most companies, you know, I talk to, because ultimately, you know, our portfolio companies will exit when they start opening their checkbooks. I mean, they are all sitting on a fair bit of cash. Their own corporate businesses are you know, growing. Economy is not in a recession, and, you know, hopefully we have avoided the hard landing, and you know, clearly, you know, employment numbers came out today and they were very good. So all of that is good. I think the biggest sticking point is the valuation. So if the VCs are willing to, and especially the late stage, the later VCs that came in, they will be the ones that have to ultimately take the biggest realized losses. The CEOs will have to, you know, figure that out as well. When I've been in these situations, we have done things like management pools and carve outs, where yeah. you create a incentive plan for the management team such that they're sitting under a lot of preferences. you know, for a certain exit value, you know, they get to benefit from that exit because there is a, you know, carve out to the preferred stack for them. So boards will have to come up with some creative structures like those to make sure that A, the management is incentivized to make an exit happen. They stay with the acquirer post exit. And then the acquisition is at a price that is more reasonable given the environment today. But not and seeing that way, happen yet.
This is such an important thing. I want to make sure for our listeners this is really clear. So people call this a carve out, and legally it's a management incentive plan. So let's say VBOR invests in your startup and you've raised $100 million and you have a 1x liquidation preference. Theoretically, the first 100 million of exit consideration goes back to VBOR's VC fund. And you, as the common founder, don't make anything. So if you own 30% of the company, you get 30% of whatever is left over from the 100, you know, or basically nothing, depending on participating or non-participating preferred. But basically, if you have an offer to sell the company at 50 million and you're the CEO, VBOR might not even get the phone call to know that this offer was even available. Maybe he wants to, you know, sell the company at 50 million and get some pennies on the dollar and move on. If you have a carve out, the management gets something like 10% of the exit consideration. So even if it's sold for 50, they get 5 million spread across whoever's in there. And so this is something that I think makes sense if the market is adjusted to the point where the multiple you're going to get for this revenue or whatever the exit sale price, if it's below the liquidation stack of how much money needs to be paid back. You know, and sometimes even that growth investor came in demanding a 4x or 2x return. And are they willing, you know, to move on that? Or could something be negotiated? That's where I think these carve outs, you know, can be effective. Even if you give a carve out to the team, there might still be blocking rights from the preferred investors. At least you knew you had an option. You might not have even gotten the email or the phone call. If the CEO knows I make nothing, at least I have a job.
Yeah, no, that's very well articulated, Andrew. And I think more boards need to be putting those in place, because I think they will be otherwise, you know, big disincentives for the management team to spend time with an acquirer going forward.
Yeah, well, it's funny, carve-outs are back in fashion. I haven't really heard of carve-outs so much being discussed in a couple of years. So it's interesting to see that. Well, look, the system does need some liquidity. These endowments and pension funds and everyone who's got their money in VC funds, even if you're an accredited investor, you know, if you want to get somebody to re-up in your next fund, wiring them their initial principal money back is a good start. So we definitely have a pent-up demand for M&A and IPOs. It'd be great to see some floodgates open and watch the bankers make a lot of money with, you know, 3-4 years of pent-up exits, you know, ready to fly out. Well, wonderful. VBOR, thank you so much for taking the time and sharing your wisdom. And look forward to speaking to you and seeing you in the real world very soon.
Sounds great, Andrew. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Thanks again. Bye for now.
Thanks. Bye.